question here. What is the meaning of honor thy father and thy mother? Does this imply the material parents or the spiritual? Because in the New Testament, when Jesus is told that his mother and brothers wish to speak to him, he says as much as to say, so what? And I have three translations. These are my mothers and brothers, indicating his disciples, the people to whom he is talking. Well, it appears that Jesus there repudiates his parents. And he does in a very special sense. And the Old Testament statement, honor thy father and thy mother, must also have a special sense. It's obvious that to honor anybody at all is not to demote them, it's not to reduce their stature. It can only be to lift them up to a proper level. Suppose when we take the primary egg and call this egg prior to the split the Adamic egg. This is the human egg. And this egg has had posited inside it the Spirit of God, that is to say the power, the intelligence, which is going to develop and raise this being to a proper functional level. Now to honor this being is to lift it up to its proper level. Later on, the being polarizes, divides, and produces children, Cain and Abel. Now, the honoring of this human is simply the raising up of this human to its proper level. So if the child is to honor the parents, he must discover what in the parents is good and worthy of repeating in the next generation and further pushing into the future. To honor somebody is to take their best qualities and stabilize them and help them to develop, to perpetuate the good of them. Now, when the Old Testament command, honor thy father and thy mother, was given, after the subsequent degeneration of the human race through their peculiar behavior, the old statement, honor thy father and thy mother, was taken by fathers and mothers and used illegitimately to try to force the behavior of the children in particular directions. Fathers and mothers made funny statements like, I have devoted my life to you, I have worked my fingers to the bone for you, I have paid for your education, I have made your life for you, therefore you owe me obedience in this thing. And this thing frequently consisted in something quite stupid. So gradually, through many generations, it became apparent that the parents were interpreting honor thy father and thy mother in the wrong way. Somehow, they were saying, to honor me is to obey me, without qualification. Now, if the command is stupid, it is no honor to obey it. It doesn't honor a mentally deficient person if you do what he says. It doesn't honor the insane if you do what he recommends. It dishonors him. Because the honoring of a person is to lift them up to their proper level. So that once the thing has been misinterpreted by the parents and used for gaining obedience or trying to gain obedience for all their commands, it follows that a revolt must occur at some time against the stupidity of the parents. The parents are requiring certain things from the children and quoting the law, honor thy father and thy mother, to justify it. But in fact, the commands they are giving are stupid commands, and it is no honor to the mother and father for the child to obey them. So at this point, Christ says, call no man your father on earth, because one is your father, namely the absolute source of all beings. And when the terrestrial mother comes knocking at the door, saying, come home, it's time for din-din, when he's talking about eternal spiritual truths, He just turns around and says, these are my father and mother and my brothers and sisters who do the will of this Father, the Absolute from which we all derived. To honor your father and mother terrestrially, in the real sense, is to take the better side of their nature, see in what direction it points, and try to carry it a step further to improve it. If you actually improve on the purposes of your mother and father, and concrete certain of their potentials in actuality in the world, then you are honoring them. But if you take any of their bad side, their weak side, their egotistic side, and allow this to dictate a series of erroneous actions, then you are not honoring them, you are dishonoring them. And therefore it's the duty of every child to decide whether the commands of the parents are good commands or not. If they are, and he decides so, then he can obey them and in so doing honor his father and mother. But if the commands are stupid commands, then in order to honor his father and mother, he must disobey them. I think that's very clear on that point. We just restated the human race is derived from a human being. This human being is being created by the Absolute, and that Absolute Spirit has entered into the human being and is pressing out to develop the human being in certain directions. All the potentialities of that being have to be developed, and to honor the human race is to develop those potentialities to act. So that to take your terrestrial parents and obey them in a stupid thing is to dishonor them. But to obey them in the sensible thing is to honor them. Is that clear enough?
Yes, sir. Who decides on the stupid or sensible thing?
Who decides? Quite obviously, the decision will always be made by an individual. If you allow another individual to make your decision for you, such as your parents, then automatically you are disarming them. Because the essential part of the human being, that which constitutes his humanity, is the inbreed spirit of God. And every child has got that. And it is that in him which is to decide. Now it's perfectly obvious that if the original parent were sensible, first thing he would tell the child, as soon as he's old enough, is you have inside you an inner center of decision. This center is intelligent and it can evaluate things properly. And I, as your parent, telling you about the origin, intelligent, sentient power, tell you that inside yourself you have this responsibility. And therefore you must decide what you're doing. And the parent who says to the child, you must decide, places the child in such a position that the child cannot do other than make a decision. His powers of decision are then encouraged by the parents. And if the child then makes a decision, he's honoring the parents. And he can't not make a decision. If he says, I refuse to make a decision, he has made a decision. And the parent then says, well, you're making a decision now. This refusal is a decision. And you are responsible for that. And so he teaches responsibility and refers the child always back to center for decision. So when the child goes to the parent outside and says, I want to know what makes the moon tick, the father says, well, the present state of astronomical knowledge at the moon is roughly so-and-so. And if you want more information, there's an encyclopedia over there. Unneeded. And the child is forced to make his own decisions in this way by the continuous restatement of decision as a power inside everybody. He's becoming self-reliant and self-reflective and is therefore honoring his parents. But the child that continuously is brought back by the balance to ask perpetual permission for every act until finally he hasn't got a center of decision in consciousness and has become a mechanical thing determined by the whims of the parents, is disowning the parents. I mean, see quite enough of this in mental hospitals all the time when you see this kind of breakdown. But there are not people with no power of decision. And when we examine them, we find the cause is generally that their power of decision was taken away from them when they were very little, because the parents wished to retain the control of the situation. And they couldn't stand anybody making a decision in the situation other than themselves. And thus they dishonored the children. And the children then dishonored them. And this is the point. If the parents honor the child, they honor the center of decision in the child. But if they dishonor the child, they obscure that center of decision. The child then depends on the parents and cannot decide. And that dishonors the parents. You will often find in discussions about juvenile delinquency some very naive men who are saying, it isn't the children who should be whipped, it's the parents. Because obviously you have to account for it. During the war from 39 to 45, a lot of children were evacuated and running about and were deprived of proper orientation. Now, they have provided the great numbers of juvenile delinquents and teddy boys and so on. Who is responsible? Those children? No. Who is responsible? The parents? Were they responsible? If you remember our use of responsibility, we spell it with the response, the answer, and with an I in it. Responsibility. Well, there should be an A in it, responsibility. Responsibility is the ability to respond, to reply adequately to a stimulus in a situation. The responsibility is that which is defined of somebody from above. Thus, if you go into a court and you've been brought to court because of some misdemeanor, and the man on the bench says, I hold you responsible, he is holding you responsible. He's not holding you responsible. As soon as that vowel R, which means that expansive energy has been contracted, down to responsibility, it is a statement. Responsibility is defined from above by one man about another man who has no ability to respond. Take the classic case of the Hunchback of Notre Dame. He can hardly talk, and he's deaf, and the judge is deaf, and the judge defines him as responsible, and he says, yes, it's a war, Your Honor, and then he gets beaten. He's responsible, not responsible. So, this question of legal responsibility is about a quality that people are supposed to have, which they have only by virtue of somebody above them defining them to possess this quality. They haven't got it. For instance, how can you possibly avoid breaking the law if you don't know the law? St. Paul says, before the law, there was no sin. Because whatever you were doing, before the definition was made, you couldn't say whether it was right or wrong. When the definition came to be, somebody had made the definition. Now the man who made the definition had an army behind him. And all the other fellows who hadn't read the definition yet were just fooling about, rolling in the clothes and so on. And along came this man with his herald who unrolled his definition and read out, you are responsible. Now they didn't know what he meant, but suddenly they were hit with a club. And the word responsible was engrammed with a blow from the club. And immediately that responsibility means a bang on the head. This is how responsibility became into dispute. Meanwhile, the man who made the definitions has responsibility, which he never confers on anybody else at all. Now, the parents hold the children responsible. But if the parents themselves are not responsible, their definition has been passed from their parents and their parents, from some of the original definers of the law. None of those, if you like, fooling about with full permission of that great judicial director, what's his name, rolling about, enjoying themselves like they used to do, different meaning of me. Through the mill. While they're rolling about, thinking that it's permissible, Moses is upstairs, hammering away on these blocks of stone, and he comes and writes down, "You can't do that there yet." And shouts at them, and points to the clouds and says, "There's a big fellow up there, and he doesn't like it." And he imposes on them fear by re-stimulating their experiences of the past, of pain and misery and deprivation. And he says, "It's because you behave like this that you're hand to go in the desert." It isn't strictly true, but it will do. And so gradually they get a sense of guilt. Guilt means they're impotent to do anything about it. And they're now responsible. He was responsible when he was busy out there thinking out how to curb their behavior and hammering these bits of glass of Paris. Here we have the simple fact that the derivative egg from the parent egg can only honor the parent egg by developing the powers of that egg. Three levels: thinking, feeling sensitivity, and will drive. If you're increasing your understanding, increasing your sensitivity, increasing your willpower, you are honoring your parents. But if you are not doing those things, you are dishonoring them, because that's what you want to be doing. And if your increase of understanding annoys your parents, or your willpower annoys your parents, and they try to curb it, and they curb it unintelligently, and then you break out, they have been trying to dishonor you. And you are honoring them by disobeying them. While we're on this question of responsibility, we have another question, a terrible question, about the responsibility of one person for allowing things to come out of his mouth that might rattle somebody else's eardrums and then determine their behavior. We've said before that if you get certain sounds coming out of the mouth and impinging on an eardrum, funny ears, the vibrations in this voice going in that ear, go inside the mind, circulate, and settle down into a conceptual pattern. Now, the question is raised, is this man responsible for what he says? And are these people legitimate if they complain that what he said precipitated them into some form of behavior later? We actually know that people frequently have trouble from listening to truth. Let's see why. There is any being, there is his immanent center, his pure initiative self. A stimulus comes from outside, maybe from the voice of his dear mama, saying Albert, or some other such thing. Now, when the force from inside meets the force from outside, the two together produce a rotation. All forces in opposition produce a zone of rotation. That rotating force is then an idea, and it's a complex one, made of many such stimulus and reaction situations. It's a concept. Now, who is responsible for the creation of this idea? The man who speaks, or the man who attends to it? Because the particular conceptual structure inside that is a product of the action of the stimulating voice and the reaction of the center to it. If you remove this force from inside to oppose it, so there's no opposition whatever, then the entering force goes straight through the being and out again, leaving no trace. Only in the presence of opposition can you generate this rotation. So that when a concept is struck up inside somebody's mind and somebody has spoken, it isn't only what has been said, but what has been done with what has been said that comes, you see, complex structure of forms we call a concept. And the most often repeated form that any human being has as a child is his own name. It starts very, very early. Little Sammy is very pretty. Little Sammy wants his dinner. Little Sammy wants potty. Little Sammy wants chocolate. And so on. Whatever it is, it's Little Sammy. This is quite natural. You want to make little Sammy's organism respond, so that when you shout, "Sammy, come home for tea," he will come. So you keep reciting, "Little Sammy, Little Sammy." Now, he comes out to meet this, and the result is Little Sammy is set up as a concept. And because it is the most often repeated one, it becomes central to the individuated egoic structure. Now, all subsequent things like falling on the knee, Little Sammy has fallen on his knee. Falling on the knee accretes to Little Sammy. Little Sammy has stolen the mincemeat. That accretes to Sammy. Little Sammy has had a secret affair with a 5-year-old girl around the corner, and so on. This builds up gradually round Sammy, this concept, group of ideas based on repetition of the name Sammy and the experiences that he has. Now this group of ideas is the one we call the egoic group. And you'll observe that it's been set up between the imminent self center and the external limit, the perimeter. It is not the true center. The true center isn't called Little Sammy at all. But this center, this egoic center, is a false center set up in the action man between the true center and the perimeter. Now, as soon as this thing has been well set up, no matter from what angle a stimulus comes, the energy is always tracked across into the individual concept group. And the individual concept group then mechanically interprets this incoming stimulus and itself reacts so that whatever stimulus comes in, it reacts to it and sets up another little rotation around it. This way it builds up for itself its individuality. Gradually then it's established a line of least resistance from the sense organs into this ego group of ideas. Now this is the group that is going to be defended most violently when the person is attacked. He's not going to defend his imminent self, because the whole accent of being has been shifted from true center into this conceptual being. Now, as long as he's eccentric, that is, off his true center, his action is bound to be impaired. He cannot be what he ought to be, namely free, because it is a mechanical structure created by incoming energy and outcoming energy producing a little machine, a concept group. So, whenever that reacts, it reacts mechanically. And because it is built up in a certain environment, it necessarily is confined mechanically to the kind of environment in which it is built. It cannot respond adequately outside that environment. So if you bring up a child in the Bantu tribes in Africa, and then suddenly whip him out at 21 into London and let him loose, you will not have adequate reactions to deal with the blonde lady in Leicester Square. You just won't have the equipment to place it. The result will be you will get into trouble. And it therefore becomes necessary, periodically, and at specific times in the history of civilizations, for some other forces to come along that talk about this center, the imminent center, and teach people not to identify with the egoic complex of ideas, simply because it is too mechanical and too determined by specific environments. And this voice speaking here about the center is requiring a re-accenting of the being. It's requiring a shift of stress from the action man into the immanent center. Now, as soon as that force of the stimulus comes, it sets up another concept. It doesn't go immediately and make the person self-conscious in the proper sense, but it goes in and says that is a possibility. And the energy coming out to meet it, the two together, make a new concept. It's still a concept, but it's now a concept that there is an imminent center, the center of freedom. And these two concepts, the new one and the old egoic one, are going to fight. Every time a new stimulus comes and reinforces the concept of the imminent self over against the egoic self, there's a trembling of fear in the egoic centers, and because they have been inbuilt to protect themselves, anything whatever that refutes their existence causes them to tremble, and the reverberations of their trembling pass through the being as anxiety. They are under threat. They don't want to know about it, but they feel something is coming in. It doesn't allow them to exist. They're going to be rubbed out. The new truth then acts in fact as a disintegrating force on the old one of the egoic self. Now we call this egoic structure here being built inside the action man, the old Adam. And the new Adam is the awareness of that inner self, the immanent spirit. And the new Adam is going to fight the old Adam inside. And it's two conceptual groups, and they're fighting for the incoming stimulus energy. The next time you're stimulated, the energy starts to track over towards the ego, and is suddenly bent round and whipped into the concept that reminds you of the immanent center. As it is carried in, the egoic center feels deprived of that energy, and immediately a depression settles down in it. That depression then starts spreading through the being. Now, if the being hasn't thoroughly learned that the observer is not the observer, he becomes identified with the depression. And in that state, he may move towards concepts of dying, even towards concepts of suicide. Now, the thing that wants to commit suicide in him is this egoic center. Very often, in dealing with mental patients, we find them saying, "I want to die." And if we get them to repeat this statement, "I want to die," and say to them, "Who is saying it?" and listen to the voice, they discover that it's not themselves saying it, it's somebody else. That there's a mechanical tendency in here, whenever failure is presented, to want to get out. Explain one's failure away, and if one fails, then get out and die. Because, as the Bard said, "Good name, little Sammy, good name in man and woman is the immediate jewel of their selves." Immediate jewel, the first jewel they've got. It's only a jewel, but it is the first one, their own precious name. And if they can't make their name in the world, they want to die. And yet if you ask them very carefully what it is in them that wants to die, suddenly you see a smile flitting over their faces. The thing that wants to die is the egoic self. Why? Because it's no good. All right, let it die. Let it die. There is another self, other than that one, inside. When this one has died, then you live to that one. Now, dying is the same thing as corruption, disintegration. It is a very unpleasant sensation. But if you know that it is a necessary process that the old egoic complex shall disrupt, shall corrupt, shall disintegrate, shall die. If you know that and affirm it, then you are affirming the death of the old Adam and the rebirth of the new Adam. Now, whose is the responsibility? Let's have a look. Here is a man with a very strongly stressed egoic concept, getting him into trouble. Here is another man whose action band has been equilibrated so that he can perceive the whole thing without a false action on it. And he knows about his imminent center. And because he knows about it, he knows that you're better off without this false stress on the egoic complex. And he knows that he can speak, he can let this imminent center pick up transcendent spirit's message, which goes through, comes out here, and speaks to this other person. He knows exactly what's going to happen. When he speaks and reminds this other being that there is an imminent center, non-egoic, insofar as it promises power, increase of willpower, increase of idea power, increase of feeling power, this egoic thing will try to absorb it and grow on this new power. He knows it must do that. So that as soon as the technique of yoga or anything else is taught, drawn in from the transcendent into the imminent and spoken out, that the egoic center in another person is going to try to assimilate this insofar as it confers power. But if it does manage to assimilate it in terms of power, it is going to refute itself. Because as it grows in power, it is going to characterize itself completely inside here as a will to dominate. Now that will to dominate is going to hurl this being against other beings. He's going to try to impose on other beings. And there are an infinite number of them. So that as soon as the ego center absorbs the concepts of power from the new teaching, it always interprets in terms of forcing another person into subjection. Now there are too many persons about the place to be forced into subjection. It's a full-time occupation. It's really a full-time occupation forcing one into subjection, because it too has an imminent center which responds to every stimulus coming in, every command, by making a new concept. So the strange fact is that when the truth about the imminent center is stated, it is accepted, absorbed by the ego center, because it promises power. And therefore the ego center opens up for it. But as soon as it discovers the implications that it cannot use this power for its finite egoic ends, then it doesn't want anything to do with the teaching. But it's too late, the thing is in. And the teaching has set up inside the new concept. There is an imminent center there. There is spirit within, and that spirit is the same in every other being. And it's the same as the transcendent spirit. So then the fight begins. And the more the egoic center struggles against it, because two forces in opposition always cause a rotation, the more it struggles against it, the more concepts are generated between them, and the hotter the fight becomes. And the victory must go to one or the other. Now, if we insert ideas very quickly into an unprepared person and make them thoroughly aware that they can never get away with this power game, because they're fully stressed on the egoic center and they haven't learned to detach themselves from it, the proof that you can never get away with the individual power game is the same thing as the denial of that individual's life. He wants to get out, he wants to commit suicide, because you've said he can't win. And because of this, it is not usual to go to an unprepared person and give him a full metaphysical proof that he can't get away with. If you do it prematurely, all you do is throw him into profound despair. But if you insert the idea that the observer is not the observed first, and then teach him that he doesn't depend on any function whatever in the action man. You give him the possibility of a new kind of security in the center. And if this is done gradually enough, he can shift his action day by day, bit by bit, off the egoic center into the immanent spirit. It can only be done safely if it's done in degrees. If it is done too fast, the fight between the new concept and the old concept, the new Adam and the old, is experienced as very, very uncomfortable. And it may result in temporary breakdown. Now, a temporary breakdown, if somebody is there who knows what it means to take care of them, is not so bad, because they can be sheltered and brought back gradually to understand the true position. But in today's highly technical civilization, if you get that kind of breakdown and there's nobody there to look after you, you are whipped very quickly into a hospital and the electrodes are placed on your poor old crumpet and your exercises are blown away. And you then have to start again. So because of this, in general, the thing is done in a series of steps. You are given an awareness of the center as intelligent, as power, and as having your welfare at heart long before you are required to disrupt your egoic center completely. You have to be given another limb to stand on before one is cut away. Who is responsible? We had a debate in the hospital the other day, and this was the sentence that was put out. Who is the observer? This is the same thing as who is responsible, because there is no responsibility other than in conscious power. This is put out as a question. Who is the observer? I said it wasn't a question and could not be considered to be a question, because who is nominative and refers to a conscious person. So it is not a question. If we reformulate it, it says conscious person is conscious person. It isn't a question. And the Jungian psychologists who were debating this point wanted to know who it is behind the symbols. And they thought it was a question. Who is the observer? But it cannot be a question, because the first word means the same as the last word. So it's really quite a simple, straightforward statement. Who, that is, the conscious being, because who means conscious being, is the observer means conscious being. Who is who? Observer is observer. Conscious being is conscious being. It isn't a question. The absolute sentient power is who? He is the who. If you put an N on the end of it, it becomes accusative or dative, who, because N means something. It is now objectified. So the whom is the who substantiated, now standing as an object. So if you said who is whom, you would say subject is object. And the absolute identity of the subject and the object is the ground of all true metaphysics. If the subject and the object were not absolutely non-different, then the object could never be known by the subject. The object is really, as we've seen before by the meaning of the word of, is a modal operation of the force of the subject. The subject's own force, own power, modifies or modulates or produces motions within itself, and these motions are its object. So the object is the motion of the subject. Now, who is responsible? Responsible is the same thing as able to respond. Who is responsible is not a question, it is a statement. That only is responsible, which is a who, that is a conscious being, a power. The conscious being is responsible, and no other kind of being can be responsible. Now, it's been put to me several times in the last few weeks that if a man becomes schizophrenic through reacting to a truth sent to him from outside, there's a man with a strong egoic center, no awareness of his imminent self, and the truth is fired at him, and then his egoic center disintegrates, and in this process of disintegration, he is termed schizophrenic, meaning he is disintegrating. If that has arisen from the stimulus, and the stimulus came from a who, that is from a being, then the who is responsible for giving the stimulus. But if there hadn't been a force inside to meet it in the first place, and in all initial stimulus situations, to build up that egoic false center, then there could have been no reaction of the order called disintegration. So if you imagine the men at Troy with their walled city, and somebody brings an acid horse outside, who is responsible for Troy being overthrown? The men who made the wooden horse and stuck it well with soldiers, or the Trojans who come out and tow it in? Who is responsible? Who is responsible means conscious power is responsible. If anybody was responsible, now, it was the Achaean Greeks. They devised the horse. They understood more about Trojan nature than the Trojans did, and therefore their horse got in and exploded the Trojan situation. So they were more responsible, more responsible. They could have defined the Trojans as responsible, and no doubt did they were legally afterwards when trying. But the Trojans were not responsible in the situation. They were only responsible. So you see, it's a very, very subtle question. When somebody is suffering from a truth, Christ came along and he shoved truth into the Pharisaic structure of the minds of the synagogue attenders in his day. And that began to blow them to bits. And when they felt themselves falling to bits, they reacted against the man who spoke by fixing him. Who is responsible for that? Well, he was responsible and they were responsible. Their responsibility did not extend to responsibility, because he says when he's pinned up, I know what I did and they don't know what they're doing. His responsibility is greater than their response, because he determined from the beginning what he was going to do and knew what they would have to do, and therefore was an efficient cause of them doing so. Now, is responsibility a moral or ethical question? We said before that the moral is that which is convenient for ruling the situation, and the ethical is that which rational men think ought to be done by rational men to rational. Now, is responsibility an ethical or a moral concept, or is it something totally different? Responsibility is really a statement. Responsibility is a statement about power to respond. It has nothing whatever to do with moral or ethical concepts. So that when you're talking about the responsibility of a who is responsible, you're not really talking in the moral field at all. The archbishops and the great military leaders will say to their congregations and to their common soldiers, I define this responsible, meaning I require a certain reaction from you when I give you a certain stimulus. The definite responsibility. And responsibility itself knows, because it is able to respond, what it is doing, which also knows it's a very serious world we're living in. There are some crassly egotistic beings here, injuring themselves and their derivative children and so on, every day over a wide field. The truth has to be said somewhere, and yet it is known perfectly well that when the truth is said, somebody is going to object to it. Somebody is not going to like it. Somebody is going to fight it, and somebody is going to be disintegrated by it. And he accepts the responsibility, because he can't not do, because he is able to respond. And he's not interested if somebody comes along and says, on moral ground, you didn't ought to have said that truth, because it upset our little Willie. When Christ said, sorrow must come, and woe to him by whom, he was saying, the world being so constituted as it is, in such a way that the incoming stimulus and the outgoing stimulus produce between them a concept, and these build up and up and up into false centers. The world being so constituted, it must arise at some time that the truth is going to disintegrate that structure. And when it's disintegrated, then there is sorrow and suffering for the person who has had that false accent placed in it. But that suffering, properly understood, is for the benefit of this whole being. Let's consider the aspects in fairly recent teaching by different thinkers. Take that arch-humorist Gurdjieff. The child begins as an innocent self, spontaneously wanting what it wants when it wants it. And quickly the educators begin to work on it, and the child reacts to the educators, and there is built up inside it a structure of ideas which gradually become the focus of attention. Now, if you get overheated or devoted very intensely to any of these ideas, the heat of them fuses them together. And this fusion of the elements is what we call the integration of the personality. When it occurs, if it's been fused on the great heat, that is, on the great emotional excitement, it is extremely difficult to disintegrate it again. If the thing has been integrated loosely, coldly, by simple intellectual consideration, without emotional heat, it's not difficult to break it. But if the thing has had a lot of emotion involved in it, it is very difficult to break. And this growing individuality, these complex structures, is gradually filling up the being with form, and the form is all reactive form. The older you get, the more full of this stuff you become, until in the end, if you're not careful, you become a complete mechanism, a system of reaction inbuilt in an environment. And only in that environment, in similar environments, can you respond mechanically, adequately. As soon as the environment changes, you're stuck with your reaction pattern. And because of this, all this stuff in here, which the theosophists and Gurdjieff and others call personality, although we've said before, that's the inert usage of it philosophically, all these complex patterns of ideas, which are really mechanical reaction patterns, are going to be the vehicle of this being when the being reaches the point of death. So if it is a finite, mechanically reactive structure born in a certain environment and unfit in other environments, it isn't adaptable and it is not free enough for an evolving soul to utilize in all different environments. Consequently arises the necessity for re-evaluating all this data inside here And to reevaluate it requires a lot of energy. A person who thinks he's solved his problem, integrated himself, being presented with the truth of the immanent spirit, being identical with the transcendent, and this being the same in every being, and being told that all his structure of wonderful self-defense, self-aggrandishment, ambition, and so on, the machinery of success in him, does not justify him attacking another being and flooding it with his whimsies and overthrowing its own inner determination. The whole of his life has been built up to make it a mechanism to dominate the situation and force other beings to his will. And at some point in the future, he must come to realize that this he cannot do. And at that point, he's going to be very miserable. So consequently, when he's got sufficient of this furniture to make it worthwhile examining it, if he gets the right stimulus reminding him of the process, and he's taught the observer is not the observed, and then the dialectical process of analysis in polarized pairs, he then proceeds to subdivide all his experience, categorize it, understand it, and reorganize it so that to him it's just a library book of experience which cannot respond mechanically, but is useful to him if he wants to read it on given occasions. But it cannot respond mechanically once he suddenly understood it and categorized it. But in order to categorize it, he has to cut into it, sort it out. And wherever there's been a very strong emotion, that part of it is going to be resistant, because strong emotion integrates the thing just like heat on two pieces of iron enables them to be welded together. They weld better hot than they do cold. In the same way, ideas weld together better under emotion than they do cold. So at some time in the future of any being, no matter how carefully he's laid his plans and built his character and projected himself to dominate the world situation, no matter how big he is, whether he's a Napoleon or a Genghis Khan, whatever he is, he's going to fail. And at that point, if he's identified with the processes in the action band, when they disintegrate, he's going to go through a terrible death process. Now, because it is possible to fuse with strong drive and emotion a pattern to such a degree that it cannot be undone without the most extreme suffering, it is better that one should not be allowed to go to the term of full integration of a false pattern. If the pattern is false, it won't work in many different environments. But if you have actually managed to integrate such a false pattern with great emotional drive, it's going to be extremely painful to undo it. And therefore, it is better for you, before you reach that level, if you are subjected to stimuli that disrupt the small parts of your false centers and disintegrate them and allow you to reassess them with the little bit of suffering you can stand for the time being. Because if you do wait for the total thing to fuse, and it is wrong, the suffering and pain of disintegrating it in order to reassess it is far greater than can be endured by most individuals. It's for this reason that the teaching is given, and again, who is responsible? The person who gives the stimulus is responsible. He is able to respond. And he can see that the end result of a false integration in terms of suffering is so great that it is justified in giving a stimulus of truth now that will break up a temporary little egoic concept with a little suffering attached to it and scatter its elements and produce a temporary disorder and then a reassessment and reintegration. Any man who has the ability to do that is responsible. And he decides whether he will take it upon his shoulders to give that stimulus or not. If the situation is not so bad, he won't give it because he's a busy man. If the situation is very bad or moving towards a worse situation, and he can remain in the situation long enough to help reorientate it, then he will give it. Now, it is very important to see that because the who and the observer are the same, because the who and the responsible are the same, and that only a conscious being with power to do what his consciousness requires, only such a being is responsible, it follows that all beings who are not able in that sense are not qualified to judge the responsibility of such a being. So beings at a lower level cannot define the responsibility of the judge sitting at that. Here are the people. There are the 12 good men and true. The judge decides, and he is responsible, how he should direct the jury. The jury haven't undergone the special training that he has, nor have they had the continuous experience that he has, and therefore they are in that position because they've been sent a little notice requiring their presence, and they have been defined as responsible. But their responsibility is simply the fact that they've been put there by this other person above them. And the criminal in the dock and the men who collect the evidence are all only responsible. Whereas the responsible man is the man who, at the top level, has studied himself and knows himself so well that he knows the correct evidence of the evidence givers, he knows the human nature of the criminal, he knows the fallibility of the 12 good men and true, he knows the horrible, stupid, gazing mentalities of the people in the body of the court, and out of all of these he has to equilibrate such a judgment to be executed on that criminal that will help the whole of them to balance and lift on to a higher level.
That who will always remain a question to the people who have not become conscious of it.
Yes, and yet it refers quite simply to consciousness itself.
They will see it as a question for such times.
As they see, it's a statement and not a question.
Well, they ask who is the observer or who is being or who is. Who are you? All those will remain questions until such time as they will see otherwise. They'll all be statements in the end result.
They'll think a statement is a question. But when you turn your consciousness back on itself, then you know the meaning of who, and you know the meaning of observer, and you know the meaning of responsible. And these are interchangeable terms. The who, the responsible, the observer, consciousness are synonyms.
In a method of encouraging children to make their own decisions and guide them on their path, are the parents to stand back and let the child act on that decision, even though the parents may consider that the decision is not necessarily the best one?
Well, this is an existential problem, isn't it? What parents are you talking about? Well, now, if you talk about yourself, you know what you have to do when you think about it. See, the important thing is, and we've said this often, that at a certain point we must stop generalizing and come down to this. What do I know? And what am I going to do about what I know? Now, what do people in general know? What do parents in general have as a duty to their child, and so on? In a concrete situation, your little boy will come up to you and say so-and-so. With your then knowledge level, you will respond. The more conscious you are, the more accurate will be your directive to him. If you're unconscious, you will react mechanically, and you're not responsible at such a moment. If you want to be responsible, you have to become more conscious of yourself, your motives, the facts of the situation, the motives of the little boy in the case, and so on. And that's always an existential problem, right from the moment. And we have to stop this tendency to talk about things in general, problems in general, when in fact we never get such problems. We get problems in particular. Each one of us,
and each parent of that child will make a decision which may be quite different.
Very probably, because the understanding level of the two parents will be different. And it becomes a simple question. Is one or both of the parents responsible? Or is one of them responsible and going to define the other one as responsible in order to try to provoke a better level of reaction? Because if you say to somebody you're responsible, what you're really doing is exhorting them to better behavior. You're not doing anything else. Because if they're responsible, they will be able to respond and you have it. If they're not able to respond, you can define them as responsible and thus conjure into them a sense called the sense of responsibility, which may result in better action. But if you're not careful, it will result in the opposite. Because if you define somebody as responsible and say that means you do as I say, then their willfulness will define themselves as responsible to resist. And only in the existential test situation can you know. Very often the father and the mother give contrary orders to the child. The child looks at both and sees who's got the biggest muscles, who's got the loudest voice, and watches. And if mama is 6'9" and father's 5'3", and mama has red hair and shouts, and daddy wilts, then the little child goes over to mama and holds her hand and decides she is his ally. But he always signs with the victim. Because he's a good politician. Everybody's getting upset. The thing is, can you bring yourself as an individual into higher levels of consciousness so that you increase your responsibility? The ability to respond adequately in the situation is responsibility. And lack of the ability to respond adequately is the same thing as deficiency.
Would this be defined as initiation in the world of responsibility?
Yes. All initiative is responsibility. Whereas reaction, defined from above as responsibility, responsibility, when the judge says to a drunk man, you are responsible for murdering your wife, because although you murdered her drunk, the day beforehand you spoke to Willie Badger and said that tomorrow night you are going to get dead drunk and kill her. So you premeditated it, therefore you're responsible. Actually, you wasn't responsible in the situation at all, because you got caught. You would be responsible who kept his mouth shut, got nice and drunk, chuck wife his head off, wept terribly in the box and apologized, and volunteered to go for psychiatric treatment, having carefully made a plan with the doctor and the nurse that the treatment should be private and consist entirely of hashish. That would be responsible. There aren't many of those.